When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to Changes with me, Annie Mack. This is the place that we talk all things change. Hope you're doing good. There's change afoot. We're able to go to the pub soon. We're able to go to restaurants soon. The new normal is kind of on the horizon. Sending love to all the parents who have pretty much given up on homeschooling. I stand in solidarity with you. The sun is out. Let the kids play. That's what I say. Hope you're doing okay. I'm delighted to say that on this week's podcast, we are going to be speaking to author and journalist John Ronson. So John Ronson is an award-winning writer and documentary maker and the author of many best-selling books, including So You've Been Publicly Shamed, Them, Adventures with Extremists, and The Psychopath Test. You can do what I did and just buy it. You can buy like a bundle where you get like all of the books he's ever written in one big nice package. He's done screenwriting. He's also become really successful and critically acclaimed for his podcast recently. In 2017, he released The Butterfly Effect, which is a 7-episode podcast on how free internet porn changed the adult film industry. And then his follow-up to that, The Last Days of August, was about the death of a porn star called August Ames, who was Twitter shamed for an allegedly homophobic tweet. So that was kind of when all of his previous themes intersected, and so porn, so Twitter shaming, all of that, and it just kind of made sense for him, I guess, to do this Last Days of August series. And it was so compelling, such a brilliant listen. I kind of started listening to it and just got lost in it for about 2 days until I finished it. I binge listened to a podcast, my first ever binge listen, actually. That was, I've been wanting to speak to him since then, actually, and having much enjoyed his books and having the feeling that those things that he's written about in the past have never felt more at the forefront of what's going on in our society. So I thought it would be a nice time to speak to him. We recorded this chat pre-lockdown. He was in New York, where he lives, and we had a lovely time. This is John Ronson on the Changes podcast.
Okay, I'm just putting on the headphones. 1, 2, 3...
There he is.
Oh, you sound great.
Yeah, you sound crystal clear to me as well.
That's good. I just did an interview with a former Nazi and the sound quality was much worse, but that's because it was complicated. He was in Texas and it's a long story.
I would expect nothing less of you, John. Okay, let's begin. John Ronson, we are so happy to have time with you. Thank you so much for your time to start with.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's very nice to talk to you, Annie.
Do you mind if I start at the start?
Sure.
Where were you born, please?
Cardiff.
And what hospital? Can you remember?
No.
Obviously, you won't remember because you were just born.
But I remember my mother pointing it out to me once. I've got a feeling it was really close to Sophia Gardens, which was a great concert hall in Cardiff where I saw, oh my God, David Essex and Joy Division and the wow. Specials. And then the night after a Duran Duran concert, it fell down in the snow. A narrowly averted massacre of Duran Duran fans.
Wow.
And I've got a feeling I just link Sophia Gardens with the hospital that I was born in. So I think they were really close to each other.
Who was John Ronson at school? What were you like at school?
Oh, I was a very uncomfortable in my skin, very socially awkward, not that happy. Mm. And then inevitably that ended up with me getting kind of bullied when I was between the ages of about 15 and 18, I'd say.
I mean, I've read some of what you've spoken about with regards to that bullying, but it sounds like it was brutal.
It was, yeah. This all happened at Cardiff High School. And yeah, it was really bad. I mean, I was pinpointed as the most bullyable person in my class, so it was not great. Yeah, I got like thrown in lakes and blindfolded and thrown in the playground, and it wasn't good. Yeah, I was awkward and banal and uncomfortable. You know, I was a mess back then. So presumably the bullies picked up on the fact that I was a mess and that factored into their decision to choose me.
How do you think that has affected you over the years, now that you obviously have the benefit of hindsight and you can look back at those years?
I'd say it affected me in both positive and negative ways. So the positive ways was that it sort of taught me, when you're pushed to the edge of the playground and you're not in any group and you're just this person on their own standing on the edge of the playground looking in, that's kind of good training for a journalist, because we are supposed to be unaligned to any groups and off on our own as sort of free spirits, I suppose. So in that way, I think being bullied is good training for a writer, because it means you're suspicious of elites, because, you know, it was the elites that threw me into Roath Park Lake. So that was the positive thing. And it propelled me out of Cardiff and, you know, propelled me to move to London. If I'd ever thought I'd stay in Cardiff, being so badly picked on at Cardiff High meant there was no way. So that's another positive thing. It sort of set me on my adventures. I guess the negative thing is that it does stay with you. I still have quite a lot of social anxiety and I find it hard to go to parties and stuff. And I'm sure there's some weird connection there. That sort of never really. I remember when I was writing So You've Been Publicly Shamed, I met the governor of New Jersey, and he had been bullied too because he was gay. And it was just the two of us sitting in this cafe in Manhattan reminiscing about being bullied as kids and agreeing that experience follows you into new rooms. And there was like the governor of New Jersey and me, a successful writer, and we were both, I could tell, pretty sort of impacted still decades later by it. It does, those memories follow you into new rooms when you meet new people, you sort of feel, you have a sense of sort of inadequacy.
Is there a sense of mistrust? Is there a sense of knowing that, you know, the kind of being aware of the cruelty of people from a young age like that, of what people are capable of?
No, I'm pretty trusting. It was more, sometimes my problem is that I'm a little bit too trusting. Like, okay, I'd be interviewing some Nazi and then be surprised that they turn out to be like really terrible. I just remember that. I remember when I lived in Islington, I was out with my next door neighbor and I was complaining. I said, I'm making this thing about this religious cult and the leader is like being really mean to me and manipulative. And my next door neighbor said, why are you always surprised? you interview like Nazis and cult leaders and you're surprised when they turn out to be unpleasant. So I'm trusting. Like, honestly, it's more sort of, you know, weird low self-esteem thing, which also, you know, has positive sides too, because it means you don't become egotistical.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
You know, my success has never gone to my head. In fact, I wish it would go to my head a little bit more.
I'm interested, because of the nature of your job now and, you know, where you do this kind of rigorous research on everything that you decide to focus on, have you ever decided to go back and research any of the people who bullied you and find out who they are now, what they're doing?
Well, I actually did it once. I did it for This American Life, and I slightly regret it. I was invited to the school reunion.
Oh, my God.
And
how many years?
20, I think.
Okay.
It was.
Yeah.
And I suddenly had this stupid brainwave where I thought I'd go and I'd take a radio producer with me and we'd confront the people who threw me in the lake. But to be honest, Annie, it was a kind of a dick move. It seemed funny in advance, but yeah, you wouldn't want to be at your 20th anniversary school reunion, have someone turn up unannounced with a radio producer. So all the former bullies were like, well, you know, seems like you haven't changed, John. Like, it sort of backfired a bit. I'll tell you how it started. It started with me waking up in the middle of the night and realizing I was still angry with the boys who threw me into Roath Park Lake.
Yeah.
Yeah, in 1985. So I went online, I went onto Friends Reunited and found one of them and emailed to tell him that I'm now a best-selling author. So he emailed me back and he said that the reason why they threw me in the lake was because I was a pain in the ass, and the tenor of my email led him to suspect that I haven't changed. So that didn't work out well at all. God. So I did make this radio show about going back to my school reunion. And I think the first hint that it was a mistake was that This American Life put it out and they called it Who Takes the Class Out of Class Reunion. So I think Ira Glass's perception was like, why? Why did I choose to do that? And he's right. It was stupid.
And did you find that? Because I find school reunions just the most excruciating thing. I mean, I avoided the 20-year one, but I did go back to 10-year one before then. Just seeing, you kind of have this kind of everlasting image of someone in your head who is the person who, when you saw them last, and then they're obviously, people become decrepit and old and sorry states of themselves, especially those people who were the bullies and who seem to be the elite and the people in power. When you were confronted with them again, were you not just like, God, look at you, you're so not that bully that I, or were they still as terrifying?
Well, one of them, you know, you always want to think, well, I'm going to, you know, the bullies, they're not going to have good lives.
But
actually one of them is a world leading archaeologist who has his own plane. So that's
great.
That's not good.
Great news. Yeah.
The reunion itself was kind of bad. But recently I went back to Cardiff and gave a talk at St. David's Hall, which is where, when I was a kid, I went to see Dexys Midnight Runners. And this was a big concert hall. And I gave a talk there. And at the very last person at the end of the signing was this sweet looking man. And it turned out to be a kid who I knew at school, and I would call Will Davis, and I'd go to his house at lunchtimes and we'd listen to Swordfish Trombones by Tom Waits. And in fact, going to Will's house at lunchtime and listening to Swordfish Trombones was another little indicator that there was a world beyond this world that I could somehow maybe access. So me seeing Bill, and this is only like a year or two ago, was so nice. You don't want to think of your whole childhood as basically just one big bullying experience.
Of course not. It changed quite extremely for you after that, once you got out of Cardiff, right?
Yeah, like the day I moved to London, my mother dropped me off at the Polytechnic of Central London when I was 18, and my life just instantly became great.
How so?
Well, there was a guy, the guy in the room next door to me at the Hall of Residence, a guy called Dipen Joshi, said, let's go out, let's hit the town. And so we hit the town and just my life was just really good. I just relinquished all the baggage of Cardiff. I'd been overweight and I very quickly lost all the weight. So I was looking good and I was in central London and living in squats and occupying the student union building in a protest against student loans, and the Buzzcocks turned up and did an impromptu show for us, just living in the middle of London and suddenly being popular.
Do you think part of the reason why it changed so extremely and so quickly was because you just weren't in Cardiff, you weren't in your family home, you weren't, you know, just the situational?
Yeah, I could kind of reinvent myself.
Yeah, I
remember there was a boy in the year above me at college called Trevor who tried to pick on me. And it was so, I just remember thinking, no way. Like, I've just been through 3 years of that. Like, no way am I going to let that happen again. So I told him, you know, to go fuck himself. And actually, everything was fine.
Yeah. You talk openly, and you know, you mentioned it there about your social anxiety, and I remember your TED talk as well when you talked about the psychopath test, and you listed the 12 I hate saying the word disorder because it feels like it's, you know, it's not a disorder. It's just part of what your brain or whatever. But it's like, do you feel like, and I promise we're going to stop talking about your past very soon. Do you feel like that those 3 years have informed some of those, like the social anxiety and the things that you have?
Yeah, they really have. And it's such a shame. I wish it wasn't a factor in my life. It comes and goes. But sometimes it does come. I mean, this is terrible, but I'm a sort of open book, so I might as well tell you. But not long ago, like about a month ago, we bought this little house in upstate New York, which is why I'm talking to you from now. And I was invited to a party and I just couldn't bring myself to go to it. And it was to do with that, you know, there's still stuff bubbling around in there.
Yeah.
And it is to do with those 3 years. I mean, it doesn't go away. Mm.
Do you think that those experiences have informed your career path in any way?
Yeah, I think so. As I said before, being mistrustful of powerful people and is a really good thing for a nonfiction writer to feel. And I think that came from that. So good things came from it too. Mm. Being interested in why people behave cruelly towards other people. I'm trying to sort of humanize it, I suppose.
Yeah, I always think you're so forgiving when it comes to that as well. You're always very keen to look at the, to not put someone in a corner of being a binary bad person.
Yeah, I think that probably comes from it too. It's trying to understand people rather than just demonize them. I'd much rather try and understand why people behave poorly towards other people than just think they're monsters and not think about them again. Mm.
Is there anyone you don't understand that you've investigated and you just can't get to the bottom of their choices?
Actually, I'm doing a story now, which I can't tell you what it is. So this is going to be a bad story, but yeah, I'm doing a story now for Audible about a woman who I briefly tried to investigate 20 years ago, and it was a big failure. And she behaved in really interesting, complicated ways that I'm trying to figure out now. Yeah. But I can't tell you anymore.
I'm intrigued. That's enough. Now, another change, John, that wasn't quite as immediate, but definitely kind of affected how your career was shaped moving forwards, was just the idea of you being a clairvoyant and being able to grab and hold on to these very, very timely theories and cultural trends and zoom in on them.
There's been maybe three times in my life, I'd say, where I cottoned onto something before anybody else did. Mm-hmm. One was about the rise of conspiratorial thinking. And then the second time was with the psychopath test, where both an interest in psychopaths ruling the world, but also a critical look at mental health labeling and whether there's a sort of tyranny to labeling other people from afar as psychopaths or whatever. Maybe that turns you a little bit psychopathic. Again, I was having all those thoughts before they became popular and mainstream. So again, that book came out at just the right time. And then the third time was, I think I realized about the malevolent power of social media shaming and how it was a new form of forcing conformity onto people. Like, why do we tear people apart on Twitter? What's going on there psychologically? And again, like when I started writing So You've Been Publicly Shamed, everyone just thought social media shaming was cool. It was like new and cool. And So I was the first person to come along and say, well, me and Monica Lewinsky actually simultaneously were the first two people to come along and say, I think we should be looking at social media shaming in a different way.
And talking about social media, do you mind sharing with us, because we were kind of brought on your journey in social media, you coming on and off Twitter, and there's two times that you talk about in the book where you are kind of, well, the first time is the bots. And then the second time is the guy who pretends to be you. And it's just like the adventures you've been on Twitter alone. It's a real roller coaster.
Yeah, well, this so I went onto Twitter one day and noticed that there was another John Ronson on Twitter. It was John _ Ronson. But its avatar, its picture was my picture. And it was tweeting things like, going home, got to get the recipe for a plate of lemongrass and mussels, # yummy. So I tweeted, who are you?
Who is this mysterious lemongrass loving me?
Yeah. And then it tweeted, watching Seinfeld, can't wait to have, I don't know, some kebab or something.
It's kind of weirdly even more malevolent, isn't it? When it's so, you know, it's not even, it's just a different version of you. It's so weird. It's so weird.
Well, then the next morning I woke up and checked the other John Ronson's Twitter feed before I checked my own. And it had tweeted, as I slept, it had tweeted, I am dreaming about time and cock.
Okay. Yeah.
So I thought, and then I looked at its follower list and it had like 50 followers, but some were people that I knew from real life.
Oh, God.
Yeah, who were presumably wondering why I had suddenly become so interested in fusion cooking and also passionate.
And
also, sort of candid about dreaming about cock. So I tracked the inventors of this bot down to these three academics who were connected to Warwick University. And I thought, okay, this is fine. I'll just ask them to take it down and they'll take it down. And so I said, hi, can you take down your bot, please? And they emailed back and said, we prefer the term infomorph. And I immediately felt a sort of tightening in my chest. And I said, well, can you take it down anyway? It's pretending to be me. And they replied, the infomorph is not pretending to be you. It is repurposing social media data into an infomorphic aesthetic. So I just went to war with this robot version of myself.
Wow.
And eventually I met them and they were just, you know, like they were so supercilious. They kept on saying things to me like, the internet is not the real world. They had no conception. I said, this is identity theft. And they were like tutting and rolling their eyes about how naive I was. So then I interviewed them on video and I put the video out on YouTube. And I was a bit worried because I'd been so screechy. When I get annoyed, I get very screechy and it's quite unpleasant to listen to. And so I thought all the YouTube comments are going to be mocking my screechiness. But no, all the YouTube comments were on my side. It was like, who are these terrible academics? And I was like, so pleased. I felt like Braveheart. But then the messages were getting like darker and darker. As you went down the list, it was like, you know, it was only like four comments down where people were saying, let's gas these cunts. And I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
And that's what gave me the idea to write the book about social media shame.
Amazing.
Well, that was one of the ideas.
Yeah. So you actually saw and kind of created in your own way, not meaning to, but an actual public shaming off the back of these guys.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then around the same time I moved to New York, this was about 2012. And because of my social anxiety, I found myself sort of isolating a bit in New York and not going to parties and spending too much time on my own and sort of not being happy. I was homesick. I missed London. Mm. And I felt like I was floundering in New York. And then when I would see people getting publicly shamed on Twitter, so for instance, probably the most famous story from that book is this PR woman from New York, Justine Sacco, who got on a plane to Cape Town. And just before she got on the plane, she tweeted, "Going to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS, just kidding, I'm white." And then got on the plane and turned off her phone and fell asleep. And while she was asleep, she became the worldwide number one trending topic on Twitter. And partly because I thought, like, everybody was just so thrilled that there was this woman asleep on a plane and we were destroying her. And she had no idea that she was being destroyed. And people thought that was hilarious. They were tweeting, "We're about to watch this Justine Sacco bitch get fired in real time before she even knows she's being fired." And I thought, and as I watched this unfold, I mean, at first I thought what everybody else thought that night, which was, you know, great, somebody's fucked. And then I had two thoughts. The first was, as a fan of Randy Newman and South Park, I kind of recognized her tweet as not as racism, but as a badly worded joke that was mocking her own privilege. She was making fun of herself, her own like bubble of ignorance. So it was a self-reflexive joke about herself. And nobody else seemed to get that night. Everybody was just so excited.
Trying to get it, right? I think that's the common thing, is it kind of you find a way for the rage to kind of work for you, and you don't ever try and look for nuance.
Right, willful ignorance. And also the flame was burning so hot that night that if anybody did tweet, "I'm not sure that Justine Sacco deserves what's happening to her," people just piled in on that person too.
Yeah.
And I remember there was Helen Lewis, a journalist from The New Statesman. She was like one of the only people that night to tweet, "I'm not sure that this is deserved." And people piled in on her and she went silent. And I thought, journalists, we're supposed to speak truth to power. We're supposed to be unafraid of powerful people behaving appallingly. And yet the night of the Justine Sacco incident, everyone was scared. And because I was sort of flailing a little bit in New York myself, I found myself empathizing more with her than with the people who were tearing her apart. And so that was the other reason why I wanted to write that book.
Let's talk about The Last Days of August, which was a podcast that I really was just so transfixed by and enjoyed so much. And just your discoveries into this world of porn. I'm really interested in your take, having immersed yourself in this world and been exposed to so much of the inner workings of it. I'm really interested in your kind of take on the kind of porn industry now in 2020 and how you feel it is doing.
Well, I spent about 3 years making two podcasts, The Butterfly Effect and The Last Days of August, both about the porn industry. It started because I realized that Pornhub had really decimated the lives of porn people, because Pornhub's a depository of pirated content illegally uploaded by fans. And of course, you know, it's watched by hundreds of millions of people. And so hundreds of millions of people are complicit in taking money away from the pockets of porn performers. You know, we barely care when it's musicians who are complaining about not having any money anymore because of piracy and streaming services and so on. So we barely care when it's musicians, but we certainly don't care when it's porn performers, because we don't want to think about their lives, because we need to... we need to dehumanize.
Desensitize it. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
I met this woman called Dakota who was addicted to Pornhub, and I asked her if she ever learned the names of the porn performers, and she said, "No, it's like when you kill a deer, you don't name it because then you can't eat it."
Oh, God!
I know. And because I've always been really interested in hypocrisy. It was the hypocrisy of that really made me want to do that show. I want to name the deer. So that's why I made The Butterfly Effect, which was a very sweet, warm podcast about how porn performers are trying to survive in the days of free streaming porn. And what are the consequences? What are the ripples? And I found the most amazing ripples. The most amazing one being this new world of bespoke porn, where professional porn performers will now make an entire porn film for just one person.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, so interesting. Like, if you've always wanted to see a porn film, but it's so weird that nobody's ever thought to make it, you can now commission porn people to make that film just for you.
Wow. Wow.
And what an insight into a person's inner life to... Yeah. To see what porn film they commission. So that was all very sweet. But then a few months after we finished making The Butterfly Effect, a porn performer, August Ames, took her life the day after a social media, or the same day as a social media pile-on. And I thought, well, I've written about social media pile-ons and I've spent a lot of time in the porn industry. I should look into what happened to August. And that's how The Last Days of August began.
How do you feel now about kind of the exposure of porn to a generation of young kids? I mean, like, is there like an average age when you're going to experience porn or something, like 11 or something?
It's like 11 or 12 that kids start watching porn. I mean, Pornhub is now sex education for children all around the world. It's how most children learn about sex is through Pornhub. And of course, you know, a lot of the videos on Pornhub are the last things that kids learning about sex should be watching.
As a mother of two boys, I'm just like, how am I going to navigate this when the time comes? Because I'm always really interested in, not, you can't take stuff away, but it's like you have to try and, I'm trying to teach my sons about real bodies and real things like female orgasms, which you don't often see on Pornhub, and you know, the real way of actually being able to respectfully go to bed with a woman. It's just, or a man, obviously. It's just terrifying. What do you know about the psychological implications of this kind of this new stat of 11 years old?
Well, at the same time that Pornhub and the other streaming sites like YouPorn and so on became really big, there was a massive rise in erectile dysfunction among young men, 18 to 24 year olds. Erectile dysfunction has risen by 1,000% in 18 to 24 year olds. And I mean, if I can hazard a guess, part of the reason is what you just said about women's bodies and so on. Like, if you're looking at these perfect bodies, then you get a sort of false, screwed up sense of bodies. And I think the other thing is the way that, you know, kids watch Pornhub. They'll have like five videos up at once, and I'll watch one for 10 seconds and watch another one for 20 seconds. And that is so unlike actual sex when they try and have actual sex, they just can't function.
Yeah. How have you navigated like all of this as a parent, you know, having this greater insight into the world of porn?
Well, actually, my son is very sensible. He was the first person to tell me about Pornhub. I'd never heard of Pornhub. But when he was about 12, he came home from school and said, all the kids at school are talking about this thing called Pornhub. So he's the one who told me. But he realized really early that I think that, you know, sort of violent porn and so on is just horrible. And so I didn't really have to say anything to him. He figured it all out for himself very, very early.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Are you a catastrophist? Do you think that we're all fucked?
I am a little concerned about Trump getting a second term.
Yes, that's that. Do you think he's going to get in?
I think maybe he's not going to get a second term. In May 2016, I tweeted that I thought that Trump was going to win the election, and everybody called me, I was an idiot, and there was no way that Trump would win the election. So I've got a pretty good track record of getting it right. And I think that moderate Democrats are so terrified of a Trump second term. It's visceral here in America. People just can't stand to have Trump in their heads.
Yeah.
It's so stressful. I mean, just think, if Trump gets a second term, Ruth Bader Ginsburg will die on the Supreme Court. I mean, she's really old. She's not going to last another 5 years, which means there's going to be a greater preponderance of conservative judges on the Supreme Court, which will mean that, you know, Roe versus Wade will be badly affected. Immigration, you know, Trump just doesn't want to stamp out illegal immigration. He wants to put massive controls on legal immigration too. Not to mention his disregard for democratic values and the rule of law and the separation of powers and so on, all the things, checks and balances, all the things that are at the very basis of American democracy. The idea of a Trump second term is really frightening, I think.
One last question before we let you go, John, and I wanted to ask you about mental health and just the huge revolution about it. You know, the discourse now is so public and so prevalent of people talking about it and kind of revealing their kind of mental health struggles and tweeting about it, and, you know, all of it. Do you feel like it's going to help people with mental health, essentially, this idea of it finally being out there in the open, people talking about it?
Yeah, and I think it's already helped a lot. I remember, this may be a false memory, but I'm sure I remember my mother driving me home from school one time when I was about 10, and her pointing at a house and saying, the man who lives in that house has got manic depression. And I remember thinking, whoa.
like a horror film or something. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And those days feel really long gone. And so I think by and large, almost entirely, people's openness about mental health is extremely positive. It's humanizing, which is another reason why I hate social media shaming so much. I mean, my show about August Ames shows that when somebody behaves erratically on social media, almost always it's because there's some other stuff going on in their lives. That they're upset about other things. They've got various struggles. And so when we tear somebody to shreds on social media, define them by some badly worded tweet when we don't know anything else about them. I'm not necessarily talking about celebrities here, but just private individuals who we know absolutely nothing about. There'll be an awful lot of other stuff going on in their lives. So the more we know about our struggles with anxiety and depression and so on, just the more holistically we get to think of other people.
Yeah.
It can feel shameful to be so socially awkward that you can't leave the house. You feel ashamed. And then when you realize that lots of other people feel the same way, and depression and anxiety is very common, and also sort of rarer disorders like borderline disorder, for instance, is much more common than you think. And these things don't make you a freak. It's just all part of being human. The more curative it is, what's the cure for shame? The cure for shame is empathy. I think people being very open about their mental illnesses and mental disorders is just a very, very positive thing.
Well, maybe I won't catastrophize everything else. And even that is one great thing. We might all be fucked, but at least we can talk about what's going on in our heads.
Yeah, we're sharing, and it's there's something really lovely about that. Yeah. People come up to me a lot. I've been doing this live show, not very often, but I've been doing this live show about making The Last Days of August. And I talk a little bit about how making that show gave me a bit of a breakdown. I became depressed for the first time in my life. I was diagnosed with this thing called situational depression. And a lot of it was to do with just the stress of having to make that show responsibly. She her real name's Mercedes Grabowski. She just lost her life, and I had found myself having to figure out what happened to her.
Yeah.
And it was one of the biggest responsibilities of my life. And it the sort of pressure got too much, and I ended up with this thing called situational depression. So the situation made me depressed. And it only lasted a few weeks, and then I was like, fine, and I've been fine ever since. But I talk about it on stage a bit, and afterwards in the signings, people come up to me and talk about how useful it is and how important it is to talk openly about this stuff. And I think it is. I think it's very beneficial to talk about these things. It really does help other people.
John, I'm really, really grateful for your time once again. It's been so nice chatting to you. And yeah, just thank you so much.
Thank you, Annie.
Thank you so much to John Ronson. Do check out his Audible series, The Butterfly Effect, and The Last Days of August. Also, Okja, which is on Netflix, and read his books. So You've Been Publicly Shamed. I mean, at the moment, there is a different person being cancelled every single day. It's so timely, that book, even though it was written years ago. So do go check that out. It's a really interesting insight into the whole idea of public shaming. And of course, follow him on Twitter at John Ronson. As long as you're not an Autobot, that would be great. Thanks for all your messages about the show so far. Holly BMP sent this review on Apple Podcasts. I've had so many jaw drops during the conversations I've listened to so far. Thank you for asking such crucial guests to come and speak their truths. Thank you, Holly. I'm so glad that you guys are getting something out of these podcasts, that you're feeling that they are useful and that you're learning something. I know that time is precious, and you know, when you step out of the house to have a bit of time to yourself and in your own head, that choice that you make is really precious. And if you're like me, you want to feel like the choice that you make sometimes is useful, like you're not just being entertained, but you're also learning something, you're kind of growing in some way by listening to it. So I'm so glad that you think that way, Holly. Next week on the podcast, something a little different. I'm not going to say any more, except you really won't want to miss it. This episode was produced by Matt Hill at Rethink Audio. Take care.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.